You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. This episode deals with details of suicide. If you are distressed or feel like you need help, please call Lifeline. You can find links and numbers in the show notes. Retired schoolteacher Celia Blay lived in White Waltham, UK. She was mourning the loss of both her parents and had a lot of extra time. Time she spent surfing the internet. During one of her searches, she stumbled upon a website for people contemplating suicide. Celia never knew something like this existed, and she was intrigued. She read the open forums and felt encouraged to see how many people care and supported each other to find help. As a former teacher, Celia knew how to communicate with young people and stepped in as a counselor of sorts. On one forum, she chatted with a 17-year-old girl from Central America. The girl confided in her that things were not going too well. She was the victim of abuse and had decided to end her life, as she couldn't see another way out. Celia was mortified. She knew she had to do something to help the girl. So, remaining calm, she asked her about her planned suicide. The girl said she had made a pact with a nursing student she met online called Lee Dow. Lee Dow had given her instructions to hang herself while she watched the live stream on her computer. Celia took it upon herself to find Lee Dow and uncovered that this was not her first suicide pact. She strolled into a forum where Lee Dow and another girl were in the last stages of planning their demises. Celia intervened and managed to convince the girl not to go through with it, only 4 hours before the intended event. Celia felt like she had opened Pandora's box. She made it her personal mission to warn people on online forums about Lee Dow. The deeper she dug, the more she revealed. Lee Dow also had two other handles, Falcon Girl and Cammy D. The online typed conversations were all the same. Lee Dow, a sweet and sympathetic person, convinced her online connections that suicide was the only way out. She made a pact, saying that she would watch them so they didn't have to die alone. Lee Dow instructed the intended victims to switch on their webcam so she could witness them taking their own lives. With her medical experience, she would also help them with advice if something went wrong. For months, Celia collected evidence. And when she felt there was enough, she went to her local police station. They considered the case, but did not deem it worth an investigation. They told her, "If it bothers you, look the other way." 2 years later, in January 2008, Celia and a friend, Kat Lowe, were still on Lee Dow's trail. She was using the handle Cammy D more often, and they devised a sting to entrap her. They learned that one of Cammy D's online friends in Birmingham recorded his own suicide by hanging, with the help of another member on the website who had realized that Lee Dow wasn't who she pretended to be. The two sleuths managed to track down Cammy D's IP address. It led them to a family home in Minnesota. They had kicked the hornet's nest and revealed an unsettling truth of manipulation and misrepresentation behind anonymous masks used on the World Wide Web. Nadia Kajoji was a Canadian college student from Brampton, Ontario. She had enrolled to study law and politics at Carleton University, Ottawa, about a four-hour drive from home. Her freshman year started out with loads of fun and socializing. Nadia lived in a dorm on campus and enjoyed her newfound freedom. But her carefree days of going to class during the day and partying at night were numbered. When Nadia and her long-term boyfriend broke up, she hit a bump in the road. However, she managed to get over it picked herself up, and started dating. Before Nadia knew it, she had fallen in love again. Sadly, this relationship was also short-lived, and it broke Nadia's heart. It was a complicated breakup because Nadia found out she was pregnant. They were still working through the shock of the unplanned pregnancy when Nadia suffered a miscarriage. It was all too much for her to take, and she slipped into a deep depression. Nadia changed her appearance, and the bright-eyed and bubbly freshman she used to be was no longer there. Photos show her with heavy eyeliner and a thick fringe, like she wanted to hide from the world. Her friends were concerned about her. She used to be the life of the party, the one who invited everyone. But at this point, she hardly ever left her room. If her dorm mates knocked on the door, she'd ignore them. Nadia visited her parents in Toronto in February of 2008, and they noticed she was not herself. But she didn't want to talk about it and simply said she was tired. When her mom pleaded with her to open up, Nadia said she needed time. She would tell them what was going on when she was ready. So her parents knew something had happened, they just didn't know what. When Nadia returned to Carleton, she recorded a video diary, performing songs about her failed relationship. It was clear that it was a case of unrequited love. Nadia also had a candid conversation into the camera one time in which she explained how helpless she felt. Nadia said she never meant to fall pregnant. They used a condom, and it broke. As an extra precaution, she took the morning after pill, but that also failed. She had no control over the situation. As time went by, she accepted the fact that she was pregnant and felt that it was destined to be. But just as she made her peace with the situation, she lost the baby. Again, this was not what she wanted. To Nadia, it seemed like destiny was out to get her. And that's when she disappeared. On Monday morning, March 10th, 2008, Nadia did not show up for an appointment with her counselor. The counselor went to her dorm room, hoping to find her, but she never answered the door. From inside, they heard music blaring. Students in the room next to Nadia's said that it had been playing all night. Campus security unlocked the door, but Nadia wasn't there. Her prom dress hung outside the wardrobe like she was planning on wearing it. She had left her wallet with money and credit cards, and also her iPod. Her winter coat and shoes were missing, so it looked like Nadia left on her own accord. Campus security contacted her parents in Toronto, and they had no idea where Nadia could be. Her mother had tried to reach her the night before, but Nadia never picked up the phone. Fearing that Nadia was missing, her parents traveled to Ottawa to join the search effort for their daughter. It was in the dead of the unforgiving Canadian winter, and snow was more than 3 feet deep. Nadia's father made a heartfelt public appeal for any information that could lead them to Nadia. They were deeply concerned because it wasn't like her to disappear without saying anything. During the search, Nadia's parents spoke to many of her friends, as well as her counselor. They were shocked to learn about Nadia's mental state before she went missing. Her friends told them about Nadia's antisocial behavior and how she spent most of her time in her room. The counselor told her parents that she had trouble sleeping and suffered from mood swings. She was prescribed sleeping tablets and antidepressants and often talked about ending her own life. They also learned about an incident in a restaurant where Nadia was holding razor blades in her hands. She caused a scene with blood dripping from her palms, begging someone to help her. Police were called, and after filing the incident, they escorted Nadia back to her dorm room. Her parents had no idea that Nadia had suicidal thoughts. They knew her love life was in shambles, but they didn't realize she had sunk into a deep depression. Although Nadia was receiving counseling, no one seemed to listen when she said she was so desperately tired and longed to be happy, and that she couldn't function. In her video diary, she said she was annoyed that no one took her urge to take her own life seriously. Weeks after she was last seen, everyone was still looking for her. Police scoured her computer and discovered that she had been on many suicide websites, researching methods and talking about them. Nadia spent a lot of time online, connecting with people in forums on these sites. She met a student nurse called Cami D, and finally felt someone understood what she was going through. Like Nadia, Cammie D struggled with life's ups and downs and was thinking about ending it all. Nadia's parents read the conversations between Nadia and Cammie D and were even more concerned for their daughter's safety. Nadia referred to suicide as catching the bus, a common term used by suicidal individuals. Catching the bus is often abbreviated to CTB in online conversations. Nadia told Cammie D that she was planning to attempt to jump to her death. Cammie D suggested she hang herself instead and asked if she could record herself doing so as part of a suicide pact. As a nurse, she could watch Nadia via livestream and help her to execute the plan effectively. Then, as part of the pact, when Nadia was done, Cammie D would catch the bus too. This is an excerpt from an online conversation between Nadia and Cammie D. Nadia starts by saying, "It's a big relief to be able to talk to someone." Cammie D answers, "Cool. I'm not trying to tell you how to do it. Just my experiences and opinions, that's all." Then Nadia, "I understand. We want what's best for each other." Cammie D, "Yes, very much so. I don't want you to fail ever and end up messed up." Nadia, "That would be the worst." Then Cammie replies, "Oh my God, yes, see, I see that happen a lot." Nadia cautiously asks, "What sort of stuff have you seen?" And Cammie D answers openly, "I'm not trying to scare you. Don't get me wrong. I've seen tons of failed overdoses and bad wrist cuttings and some failed jumpers. In 7 years, I've never seen a failed hanging. That's why I chose it." Despite Cammie D's insistence that hanging was the best method, Nadia did not like it. She didn't want her death to appear like a suicide. She believed that if her death were to be an accident, it would be easier for her family and friends to cope with it. So, Nadia's plan was to stage an ice skating accident. She had spotted a crack in the ice under a nearby bridge. Nadia thought if she fell through the ice with her skates on, no one would know it was her own doing. And she knew she succeeded because if she didn't drown, she would succumb to hypothermia. But Cammie D insisted that hanging was the only way to go, and if they could do it together, it wouldn't be so scary. When Nadia stopped for a minute to consider this option, Cammie D was quick to give her specific instructions. What kind of rope to choose and where to buy it, how long and thick it should be, and even how to look for a spot to hang herself from inside her dorm room. Cammie D supported Nadia's ice skating idea, but pushed her to buy the materials for hanging as a backup, in case she changed her mind before jumping. Nadia insisted that the staged accident idea made her feel more comfortable. Sunday, March 9th, was Nadia's last contact with her online confidant. She said she was ready to go and would wait a couple of hours so there weren't many people around. A blizzard was raging outside, and Nadia thought it was the perfect opportunity. She sent one last email to her dorm mates, saying that she was going out ice skating. Then, wrapping herself up in her warm winter coat and flinging her skates over her shoulder, 19-year-old Nadia Kijoji walked out into the night, disappearing into the snowstorm, never to be seen alive again. 6 weeks later, on the 20th of April, as spring arrived and the snow melted, Nadia's body was found in the Rideau River. She had jumped off a bridge into the icy river and died due to hypothermia. She was wearing ice skates, thinking of those who loved her, not wanting them to feel guilty about her suicide, and hoping they would believe it was an accident and nothing more. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or RCMP, set out to find Nadia's online confidant, Cammie D. At that point, they did not realize that Nadia was not the only one who had entered a suicide pact with an unknown person online. 3 years before her death, a British man also ended his own life. 32-year-old IT engineer Mark Drybro lived in Coventry in England. As a teenager, Mark was a happy-go-lucky guy who enjoyed making people laugh. After high school, he studied computer engineering in his hometown of Coventry and had a bright future ahead of him. Mark was close to his family, had a girlfriend and many friends. Life was good. But then his girlfriend fell ill with a mysterious virus, and Mark picked it up too. Mark described it as feeling like, you have a flu that won't go away. He was never formally diagnosed, but Mark believed he had chronic fatigue syndrome. He was always exhausted and struggled to make it through a normal day. Eventually, his relationship broke up, his friends stopped coming around, and Mark dropped out of college. Battling with his physical health throughout his 20s impacted Mark's mental health. He was in the prime of his life, but he had no energy to keep up the pace of everyday activities. When he reached his early 30s, Mark's depression had become debilitating. The once dynamic IT engineer struggled to keep down a job. After being fired from yet another contract, Mark suffered a nervous breakdown. While he was at home recovering, he commenced communicating on an online forum of a suicide website, where he met 20-something nurse Li Dao. She was kind and understanding and discussed suicide methods with Mark. She gently encouraged a vulnerable and impressionable Mark to hang himself. Mark considered her suggestions, but he felt hopeful about the future in moments of clarity and said that he didn't want to go through with it. But on Li Dao's insistence, he practiced hanging himself by tying a rope to the doorknob of his bedroom, then slinging it over the door. In the end, Mark refused to practice again because he didn't want his parents to notice the marks on his neck. Li Dao supported his decision, but nudged him to believe that suicide was the only way out of his misery. She confessed that she could no longer face the challenges in her own life and wished that he would go with her. At the end of July 2005, Mark sent one last message to Li Dao, in which he said, "I keep holding on to the hope that things might change. I'm dying, but slowly, day by day. I don't want to waste anyone's time. If you want someone who's suicidal, I'm just not there yet. You either do it or you don't, and I don't and I haven't. I'm used to being alone. Sorry. I admire your courage. I wish I had it." 4 days later, on July 27th, Mark did not show up to meet his sister Carol. They had seen each other at a family dinner the night before and had made arrangements to meet in a park near his home. Carol tried to call, but couldn't reach her brother, so she walked to his apartment. When he didn't answer the door, she let herself in. There was a note for her in Mark's handwriting. "Please, call the police. Do not go upstairs. Go home. Hand this note to the police." Carol ignored his request and ran upstairs to find her brother's body in his bedroom. Mark Drybro had hanged himself with a rope tied to a ladder, like Li Dao had instructed him to do. The coroner found bruising on the left side of Mark's neck, where Li Dao had suggested he tied the knot, so he would quickly drift into unconsciousness. Not long after Mark's death, English sleuths Celia Blay and Kat Lowe connected an IP address to online users Li Dao, Cammy D, and Falcon Girl. Like Nadia and Mark, Kat Lowe had made a suicide pact with Cammy D, but she changed her mind when she realized that she was not the only one. She was shocked to look at Cammy D with fresh eyes and saw how she used the same gentle manner with other people too. Multiple people opened up to Cammy D, and she vowed to support them to the end. And in the end, they'd catch the bus together. At this time, Kat Lowe read some of Celia's posts, warning people against Cammy D. She reached out to Celia and said she would like to work with her to expose the person behind the alias. They kept an eye on suicide websites and were sickened by how many false suicide pacts the young nurse had made. But she wouldn't only encourage suicide, she also enjoyed watching teens harm themselves. Cammy D suggested to one young lady that she ended her life, cutting herself with blades. Her tone was always caring and sweet, using terms like, "I know, hun," and she'd sign off saying, "Hugs." She seemed to respond only to the most desperate messages, like this one posted by Retard Stoner. "I need to die tonight. Period." Within minutes, Falcon Girl replied, "Check your email." This was her typical pattern. She'd find people who were ready to take the plunge, then start private conversations, giving them comfort and step-by-step instructions. In every instance, she asked them to record themselves on webcam. Celia posted on online forums, warning people about Li Dao, Cammy D, and Falcon Girl. Although the website was mainly visited by people with suicidal thoughts, it was a supportive community. Most members encouraged each other to find help or offered a shoulder to cry on. But many of them, who had had contact with Li Dao, felt she was too pushy. 22-year-old Nikola Trifunovic from Croatia posted on the forum that he could see no other way out than to hang himself. Li Dao immediately replied with her customary, "Check your email." The two of them grew very close over 6 months. Li Dao claimed she was ready to see TB, but would wait till Nikola, who used the name Jim, was ready too. They were in frequent contact, and Li Dao supported Jim and coached him to prepare for his hanging. Nikola saw some people asking about Li Dao on the public forum, raising concern that she had been quiet for a while. They speculated whether the ever-supportive Li Dao had gone through with it. Nikola jumped into the conversation and said that he had been in contact with Li Dao the day before and that she wouldn't take her own life because she was waiting for him to join her. Someone else replied, "She told you that too? Oi." Shortly after that, Nikola received a message from Li Dao's email account, li_dao05@yahoo.com. But the news was not from Li Dao. It was from her mother, Xiaopi Zhang. She said that Li Dao hanged herself in the basement, and although she was sad, she was grateful that her daughter was finally free from her pain. Nikola was devastated and felt lost without Li Dao to confide in. He experienced a sense of obligation to see through the pact he had made with her and tried to bring himself to catch the bus too. While Nikola was making his final arrangements, he saw her name pop up in another forum. He looked on in disbelief as she spoke to others in the exact same way that she had talked to him. Nikola realized then that Li Dao wasn't who she said she was. Others had suspected it, but he always defended her. But now he knew for sure. An enraged Nikola posted, "This is not Li. Not Li we know. She doesn't exist. It's some perv fucking with us." Back in the UK, Celia Blay and Kat Lowe learned about Mark Drybro's tragic death and approached his mom, Elaine. Elaine said that her son was a true blue computer guy who spent most of his time in front of his device. She shared Mark's online conversations and email correspondence between him and Li Dao with Celia and Kat. Although Mark also engaged with someone called Falcon Girl, Li Dao was the one who encouraged Mark to hang himself. She also sent a detailed email, giving Mark step-by-step instructions outlining how to plan and execute his own hanging. Elaine Drybro vowed to work with Celia and Kat to unmask this person who manipulated Mark to end his life, when he clearly stated he was not ready to do so. One day, Celia and Kat were in an online chat room with Cammy D when her webcam accidentally went on. In a split second, Celia and Kat saw that Cammy D was not a young female nurse. She was, in fact, a middle-aged man. Thinking on her feet, Celia snapped a photo of her computer screen with her cell phone. She compared the image with a photo of a man and a woman Cammy D had sent to Kat previously. Cammy D said she was the woman in the photo, a kind-looking middle-aged woman with a warm smile. But the brief flicker into Cammy D's real identity revealed that she was a man, the man in that same picture. Kat, who had built up a good rapport with her online friend, called them on it and said, "You're a man?" He replied, "Doesn't matter." Kat pretended to be completely unfazed and said, "No." She even went so far as to give him her personal email address. And unbelievably, he emailed her, using his actual legal name, William Melchert Dinkle. Celia and Kat felt the urgency to do something about Melchert Dinkle's online activities. This man was catfishing others and encouraging them to kill themselves while he watched. Celia had transcripts of at least 10 conversations in which the same person made suicide pacts with people. Where others tried to help suicidal individuals, Melchert Dinkle, posing as Cammy D, Li Dao, and Falcon Girl, was doing everything in his power to push people over the edge. Celia wrote everything she had uncovered in an affidavit and sent it to the FBI. Celia and Kate were sure something would come of it, but months went by and they still had no response. What they didn't know was that the affidavit had never made it to the FBI. As days rolled into weeks and weeks into months, Celia and Kat got tired of waiting and looked for another way to bring Melchert Dinkle to justice. By this time, they knew he lived in a small town in Minnesota. They approached local law enforcement, hoping that they could explain the urgency of the situation to them. Much to their relief, the St. Paul Police Department took on the case. Because many of Melchert Dinkle's contacts were teenagers, the Minnesota Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force agreed to assist St. Paul PD with the case. Meanwhile, Ottawa police investigating Nadia Kijoji's death were able to establish the IP address of Cammy D, the online persona who encouraged Nadia to end her life. This information led them to a family home in the rural town of Faribault, Minnesota. But from Canada's side, they were only able to learn who lived in the house. They couldn't ascertain who used the computer and posed as Cammy D. They spoke to William Melchert Dinkle over the phone, expressing concern that one of his teenage daughters entered into a suicide pact with Nadia. Melchert Dinkle confirmed that one of his daughters occasionally used the handle Falcon Girl, and he promised he would talk to her about it. At this point, the RCMP accepted the father's word for it. They were relieved that, at the very least, his daughter didn't go through with the pact. They didn't realize that they were actually talking to the person acting as Falcon Girl, William Melchert Dinkle himself. But thanks to 3 years' worth of research presented to Minnesota law enforcement by the two British sleuths, Celia and Kate, Melchert Dinkle's number was finally up. Police went to the home in Faribault that matched the computer's IP address used in the forums on suicide websites, but no one was home. Because of all the suicide pacts made online, police feared William Melchert Dinkle had gone through with it. And because there was no sign of his family, they assumed the worst. Was this a murder-suicide? Police wasted no time and quickly established that the Melchert Dinkle family was not home, because they had gone on vacation. Relieved that no one was harmed, investigators waited for them to return before arresting the 45-year-old married father of two. When police arrested Melchert Dinkle at his home, he immediately knew what it was about. He did not resist arrest and stated that he had been involved in inappropriate conversations about suicide online. Because of his medical background, he felt that he could guide people in fulfilling their final wishes. In his view, he was not a counselor, but rather an advocate. During police questioning, Melchert Dinkle admitted he pretended to be a young female nurse using three handles, Lee Dow, Falcon Girl, and Cammy D. He said he did what he did for the thrill of the chase. Former nurse William Francis Melchert Dinkle was born on the 20th of July, 1962. He lived in the small town of Faribault and was married to Joyce, a surgical nurse. They had two daughters who were teenagers at the time. Neighbors described him as a great dad who attended church regularly. The photo he had sent his online friends was a family photo of himself, Joyce, and their daughters. The one with the warm smile, whom Cammy D pretended to be, was in fact his wife. The Melchert Dinkle family lived in a beautiful single-story house at 510 Littleford Lane, with a manicured lawn and charming shutters. From the outside in, it looked like they had the perfect life. However, unbeknownst to neighbors and friends, William never had a good professional reputation. His career was riddled with issues. Patients complained that he was too rough with them and that he did not provide appropriate care. He failed to report on patients' progress and often administered the wrong medication. One time, he even dressed the wrong foot of a patient who had had a toe amputated. Melchert Dinkle, not his wife, nor his daughter, was the one who created the three aliases online, Lee Dow, Cammy D, and Falcon Girl. Each one of these personas was supposedly a 20-something nurse who suffered from depression and contemplated suicide. Using these pseudonyms, Melchert Dinkle engaged with people who wanted to end their own lives and advised them about which methods would be the most efficient. He spent countless hours over 5 years talking to others about suicide. His preferred method was hanging, and in the end, he had entered into more than 10 suicide pacts with people, mostly young teens from all around the world. After RCMP reached out to Melchert Dinkle about Nadia Kijoji's death, he became anxious and visited the emergency department at his local hospital. He said that he had a suicide fetish and was addicted to online suicide websites. His nursing license was revoked, not only because of his unethical conduct, but also because of his sketchy working record. Still, law enforcement took their time in making their arrest. The frustrating part is that Celia Blay went to the police in the UK before Nadia Kijoji ended her life. Arguably, without prompting from Melchert Dinkle, aka Cammy D, Nadia could have been saved had police followed up on the information Celia gave to them. Melchert Dinkle homed in on Nadia, as he did with Mark Drybro 3 years before, because she looked like she was serious about ending her life. Although he said he couldn't recall Mark, Cammy D, in a conversation with Kat Lowe, mentioned that she had witnessed the hanging of a young man near Birmingham. Coventry, where Mark was from, is only 20 miles from Birmingham. Also, St. Paul police confiscated Melchert Dinkle's computer. They found many photos of suicide, nooses, pictures of people hanging, personal photos of Nadia Kijoji, and an article about Mark Drybro's death. So saying that he couldn't recall who Mark Drybro was a blatant lie. While awaiting his trial, Melchert Dinkle was not allowed to use the internet in any way, shape, or form. How that was monitored, and if he complied, we don't know. His trial was brought before the court of Rice County, Minnesota in March 2011. Although he claimed he was involved in at least 5 suicide pacts, he was only charged with assisting Nadia Kijoji and Mark Drybro. Prosecution knew of these 2 cases and set out to find enough physical evidence to link Melchert Dinkle to their deaths. As for the other 5, they used anonymous handles, and he did not know their real identity or locations, so it was difficult to ascertain if they were alive or dead. The email address, lee_dow05@yahoo.com, belonged to William Melchert Dinkle, and retrospook@ntlworld.com was Mark Drybro's. FalconGirl@hotmail.com was also linked to Melchert Dinkle, and tearawayface@msn.com belonged to Nadia Kijoji. Computer forensics proved the correspondence between the victims was with William Melchert Dinkle, posing as someone else. This was an unusual case, because although assisting someone in suicide is illegal in America and Britain, no one had ever been charged for assisting suicide online. On March 15, 2011, Melchert Dinkle was convicted of 2 counts of aiding a suicide via internet chat rooms, a punishable offense in Minnesota. Melchert Dinkle was facing either 15 years in prison or a $30,000 fine. On the 4th of May, 2011, he was sentenced to 360 days in jail. At Melchert Dinkle's lawyer's request, the Minnesota Supreme Court agreed to review Melchert Dinkle's case and overturn the conviction. The reason for this was that according to state law, he was practicing freedom of speech. The High Court stated that the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protected a person's right to advise or encourage someone to end their life. However, using speech to assist with a suicide was not protected by the First Amendment. Melchert Dinkle's lawyer, Terry Watkins, told the Telegraph London, "We did not dispute the facts of the case, but our argument was always that what Mr. Melchert Dinkle did was protected as free speech and that he did not assist the acts of suicide. We are not condoning his actions, and there is no attempt to suggest that anything he did is anything but salacious, immoral, or depraved. But we believe that it was protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution." The case was handed back down to the lower court to determine whether Melchert Dinkle only encouraged suicide or if he assisted. Encouraging suicide is not a crime, but assisting in the act is. William Melchert Dinkle was found guilty of assisted suicide and given a 3-year suspended sentence with 10 years probation, providing he served 360 days. Judge Thomas Newville concluded that Melchert Dinkle intentionally advised and encouraged the suicides of Nadia Kijoji and Mark Drybro. When Melchert Dinkle had the opportunity to speak, he said, "I am sorry for my actions and what I have done. I have repented." Ottawa Police Service never charged Melchert Dinkle for his involvement under Canada's assisted suicide law. Because Melchert Dinkle was an American citizen, prosecuting him for a crime he committed from his home in the U.S. was problematic. The fact that he was prosecuted in America was enough for them. In the end, William Melcher Dinkle was found guilty of assisting Mark Drybrow in his journey to end his own life. Because Nadia Hajoji chose her own method, not hanging as he insisted on, he was found guilty of attempting to assist her. Melcher Dinkle only served 178 days in prison and received 10 years probation. Although he is a free man, his lawyer continues to appeal the conviction, hoping to clear him of all charges. William Melcher Dinkle claimed that he was merely an advocate for suicide. Of course, many people are pro-choice, that is, supporting the idea that any person should be able to choose if they wanted to take their own life or not. However, Melcher Dinkle wasn't merely an advocate. He was a predator of the worst kind, seeking out troubled souls in their most vulnerable state and guiding them down a dark and lonely road, hoping they would film their most intimate final moments and share them with him. By giving his victims clear instructions to successfully end their lives, he was assisting them. Then, to provide them with a deadline of sorts, he deceived them by making a pact. "I'll do it if you do it." It was the final emotional push, a comfort to some, knowing they won't be alone in the end. But also, it placed a tremendous amount of pressure on them to go through with it. Nadia couldn't face Melcher Dinkle's suggestion of hanging herself. Mark said that he still had a glimmer of hope that things would be okay. By his own admission, Melcher Dinkle was in it for the chase. Playing God over people's lives was a game to him. He wasn't merely an advocate who agreed with their right to choose. He was an instructor who donned the disguise of a female nurse, pretending to be warm, caring, knowledgeable, and trustworthy. Both Nadia and Mark had family and friends who cared deeply for them and would have done anything to help them had they known how desperately depressed they were. Of course, we cannot say for sure that Nadia and Mark would not have gone through with it, but if there was no Cammy D or Lee Dow, perhaps they would have turned to their loved ones for help instead of confiding in someone who only had the cruelest of intentions. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you're listening right now. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.